Welcome back, everyone, for another edition of JOS Unplugged. Again, I'm your host, Corey Smith. I'm the current chair of the resident assembly within the academy, as well as a fifth-year orthopedic surgery resident at Prisma Health in Greenville, South Carolina. Thank you again for joining us. I think we have a really cool episode for you here today. We're definitely going to have an arthroplasty flair, as I think you'll find that the October edition of the Yellow Journal does this month as well, and hopefully have some great content for you. Like we do every month, we're going to have a really interesting article with Dr. Stuart Melvin, who is an arthroplasty surgeon. He and his co-authors penned a really great article titled Outpatient Same Calendar Day Discharge Hip and Knee Arthroplasty, which is a really nice review of the current literature and recommendations concerning same-day discharge hip and knee arthroplasty. He and his authors do a really great job breaking down exactly what defines outpatient or same-day arthroplasty, and then kind of give a roadmap for how to do this and do it well, which I thought was really useful. We'll also be reviewing two articles from the October edition of the Yellow Journal, the first of which will be current evidence-based indications for modern cementless total knee arthroplasty, which certainly, if you're a resident listening to this podcast, I would certainly recommend that you review, as this may not be something that every resident sees in their training experience, and gives a really nice review of the history of cementless total knee arthroplasty, where we've come from, where we are now, and then certain outcomes and indications and contraindications for cementless total knee arthroplasty. A really nice article. We'll also review another article from the October edition of the Yellow Journal, Dual Mobility Articulations Result in Lower Rates of Dislocation Following Revision Total Hip Arthroplasty, which I also thought was a really nice article. So before we go too far, we again want to remind you that the JOS Unplugged podcast, as it is every month, is brought to you by Smith & Nephew PICO Single-Use Negative Pressure Wound Therapy System. Surgical site infections are the number one reason for readmissions after total joint surgery. Protect the work you've done by implementing PICO, negative pressure wound therapy, into your postoperative protocol, and you could reduce the risk of surgical site complications by up to 76% versus standard care. You can also reduce exudate, decrease length of stay, reduce dressing changes, reduce risk of dehiscence, and improve overall patient satisfaction. The PICO system is a small, portable, canister-free system that applies compression-like therapy to the incision and its margins. To learn more about Smith & Nephew and the PICO portfolio, or to request a demonstration, visit www.possiblewithpico.com. That's www.possiblewithpico.com. All right, let's get to it. We begin our article reviews this month with a really nice review article written by Dr. David Christensen and his co-authors titled Current Evidence-Based Indications for Modern Non-Cemented Total Knee Arthroplasty. The authors open the article with a nice discussion of the history of cementless total knee arthroplasty, noting that previously cementless fixation was attempted to help reduce risks of aseptic loosening. However, due to catastrophic osteolysis related to screw penetration into the medullary canal, this technique was relatively abandoned earlier in the 1980s and 1990s. However, throughout the article, the authors discuss recent changes over the past few years in implant design, as well as techniques for cementless total knee arthroplasty fixation, and also discuss, towards the end of the article, some outcome measures collected over the past few years, comparing cementless total knee arthroplasty to cemented total knee arthroplasty, and they also discuss some relative indications and contraindications. As we all know, total knee arthroplasty is one of the most common orthopedic procedures performed in the United States as well as throughout the world, and the overwhelming majority of total knee arthroplasty is performed with cemented techniques, usually with polymethyl methacrylate bone cement, to fix the femoral, tibial, and usually patellar implants to the bone. However, as we do total knee arthroplasty on relatively younger and more active patients, we worry about aseptic loosening and stress shielding with these cemented implants. And as the authors discuss, cementless fixation could potentially offer a nice alternative to cemented fixation without the risk of these complications. They begin by discussing implant designs for non-cemented total knee arthroplasty implants, stating that most of these tibial base plates are made of cobalt chromium alloy with an ingrowth surface on the backside to help enhance bony and osseous integration. As well as cobalt chromium, there are also tibial and femoral implants designed for cementless fixation that are composed of titanium, as well as a relatively new metal used in arthroplasty designs called tantalum, which many of us are familiar with. There are also implants designed with hydroxyapatite, which is a calcium phosphate crystal that helps to assist with osseous integration, as it is a component of human bone and can be osteoconductive. This is usually a biologically active coating applied to the fixation surface of an implant to help with osteointegration. The biggest change to implants that the authors discuss is that these implants have removed the use of augmented screw fixation for the tibial base plate. This was initially thought to help improve the stability of the implant to improve ingrowth. However, as we discussed earlier, we found that these screws could occasionally penetrate the medullary canal, causing catastrophic osteolysis, which ultimately scared most people away from this technique. However, newer implant designs do not use this and rather use pegs or spikes, particularly in the tibial base plate, to help with stability and to resist rotational forces until osteointegration occurs. With regard to outcomes, the authors nicely summarize in Table 2 and 3 the recent studies that have been published, which have shown that there's not a significant difference between patient-reported outcomes and radiographic outcomes between cementless and cemented total knee arthroplasty techniques with regards to the Oxford Knee Score, Knee Society Score, Visual Analog Score, Forgotten Joint Score, and the Knee Injury and Osteoarthritis and Outcome Score, which many of us know as the KOOS score, at 2 and 5 year follow-up. There's also recent studies by Harwin that demonstrate excellent patient-reported outcomes with a minimum of 7 year follow-up, as well as other studies that show longer-term results at 17 to 21 years with equivalent Oxford Knee scores. Overall, Table 2 summarizes that compared to cemented total knee arthroplasty, non-cemented total knee arthroplasty has comparable results with patient-reported outcomes. Table 3 also summarizes radiographic outcomes between cementless and cemented total knee arthroplasty, ultimately showing that cementless total knee arthroplasty actually may have improved survivorship in the long term with decreased rates of aseptic loosening. The authors also recognize studies that show that cementless total knee arthroplasty may have improved patient outcomes and survivorship in difficult patient populations such as younger patients and patients with rheumatoid arthritis. Finally, the authors discuss indications and contraindications for cementless total knee arthroplasty, which likely is of interest to most of us concerning this technique. They discuss that modern designs have corrected previous faults by eliminating screw fixation leading to possibly catastrophic osteolysis and have improved implant surface fixation with the use of tantalum and hydroxyapatite surfaces which may improve ingrowth. And ultimately, incorporating highly cross-linked polyethylene has improved the survivorship of these joints as well. Improved survivorship has been clearly demonstrated in morbidly obese patients with patients with a BMI over 40, particularly regarding aseptic loosening, and may be considered an appropriate implant for these larger patients. However, as we all know, cementless total knee arthroplasty may not be appropriate for all patients. As the authors note, inadequate bone stock with what they quote as soft, indentable bone and even uneven bony cuts on the tibial surface specifically may result in uneven seating of the final prosthesis and may lead to unstable implants. As they note earlier in the paper, during the first 3 to 6 months is when we're most concerned about instability of our implants. Therefore, soft bone or imperfect bone cuts may be a reason that non-cemented fixation should be aborted for more classical cemented techniques. Because of this, the authors state that theoretical contraindications for cementless fixation should be advanced age over 65 years old, as this may increase the risk of the soft indentable bone being present. Also, rheumatoid arthritis and osteonecrosis may be contraindications for cementless total knee fixation. Overall, the authors conclude by stating that total knee arthroplasty for more obese patients and younger patients who may place increased demands on their implants, as well as patients who are now living longer after their arthroplasty, may be indications for cementless total knee arthroplasty. However, this is not appropriate for all patients, as older patients, those with inflammatory arthropathies, osteonecrosis, or osteoporosis, may need more classical cemented techniques. The next article we'll review this month is a nice research article titled "Dual Mobility Bearing Articulations Result in Lower Rates of Dislocation After Revision Total Hip Arthroplasty." This was done by Dr. William Lee and colleagues from the Rothman Institute. As many of us know, dual mobility has become popular in recent years due to the theoretical decrease of the risk of dislocation due to the increased range of motion available before neck impingement on the cup, which hopefully can decrease the jump distance, which can decrease the risk of dislocation. Dr. Lee and his colleagues retrospectively reviewed a consecutive series of patients who underwent revision total hip arthroplasty at their institution from 2012 to 2016 with a minimum of 2 years follow-up. These patients were divided into patients who were revised to a dual mobility bearing articulation or patients revised to a conventional single bearing articulation. Rates of post-revision dislocation were the main outcome, but they also tracked rates of re-revision as well as complications and SF12 scores compared between the dual mobility and the single bearing groups. They also ran a multivariate logistic regression analysis to control for confounding variables. The authors reviewed 267 revision total hip patients. 94 of these were revised to a dual mobility articulation, which is 36%, whereas 173 patients, 64%, were revised to a conventional single bearing articulation. They had a mean follow-up of 37.8 months, ranging from 24 months, the minimum of 2 year follow-up, to 73 months. What the authors found was really interesting in that the dual mobility group was most likely to be revised for instability previous to their revision compared with the single bearing group, as 8.5% of patients who were revised to a dual mobility articulation were being revised for instability compared to only 1.2% of the patients who were revised to a single bearing articulation, which was statistically significant. However, postoperatively, the dual mobility patients had reduced incidence of postoperative dislocations with 2.1% versus 8.7% of continued dislocations in the single bearing articulation patients. There was also no difference in the rate of re-revision, with the dual mobility patients having a 9.6% rate of re-revision compared to 11.6% rate of re-revision in the single bearing articulation group. While they did not find a statistically significant difference between the actual number of postoperative dislocations, they did find that when controlling for confounding variables, when they ran their logistic regression analysis, they did find a significant difference in the patients who had a dual mobility liner who had a postoperative dislocation comparing to those with a single bearing articulation. What I believe the authors showed is that in the setting of revision total hip arthroplasty, dual mobility articulations do provide more inherent stability than a single bearing articulation. While we know that this is not certainly the first of its kind to be a study that shows that dual mobility articulations decrease postoperative instability, I think that this study brings a couple things that other studies may have not, which provide value to the paper. The most important being that the authors admit an obvious selection bias of patients who received dual mobility at the time of their revision hip arthroplasty, as there was a significantly higher number of patients who were being revised for instability who received the dual mobility articulation. However, despite this selection bias for patients with an increased risk of instability, they still had less instability after their revision. The authors also point out an interesting caveat in their study, which is that the patients who were revised to a single bearing articulation all received large femoral heads of at least 32 millimeters, with over 75% of the revision patients receiving a single bearing articulation receiving a head over 36 millimeters, which takes away the argument that perhaps the reason the single bearing articulation patients were having more dislocations is because they had a smaller femoral head, which obviously would decrease their jump distance compared to the dual mobility patients, therefore increasing their risk of instability. The authors also point out some important points that need to be considered, particularly by residents and young practitioners concerning dual mobility, as this is obviously not the panacea for all issues related to total hip arthroplasty, as they note that there are potential issues related to dual mobility. One of these, which is regarding taper corrosion, as there's concern that the use of cobalt chrome modular dual mobility liners may increase the risk of adverse local tissue reaction, causing elevated metal ion levels and metallosis in the hip. They also note concern that with an additional articulating surface, there may be increased wear rates with dual mobility compared to single bearing articulations. Another unique complication related to dual mobility that they point out is the intraprosthetic dislocation, which is a complication that can only really be seen in dual mobility bearings, which obviously requires an open reduction and additional surgery to the patient if this were to occur. This is also a complication that I'm not sure we quite understand, as dual mobility liners and its popularity seem to be on the increase, and we're kind of in the infancy of understanding the complications related to this specific implant. They also note another unique complication to dual mobility liners, which is that, as the same as many large diameter single bearing implants, dual mobility runs the risk of impinging on the iliopsoas tendon, which can be a major cause of pain for patients after total hip arthroplasty. Overall, this seems to be a well-done study that shows that in the setting of revision total hip arthroplasty, dual mobility liners may help decrease your risk of instability postoperatively, particularly if this is the reason the revision is being done. However, as with any newer implant, we must take into consideration possible new and unique complications, as well as issues that may affect the patient long-term. Well, we are pleased to welcome with us this month Dr. J. Stuart Melvin, who wrote an awesome article that is going to be featured in the Yellow Journal this month titled Outpatient Same Calendar Day Discharge Hip and Knee Arthroplasty. The title carries a lot of meaning, actually, which we'll get into here in a few minutes. Dr. Melvin, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yes, sir, absolutely. So we always kind of like to get started by welcoming our guest and giving you a few minutes to kind of talk a little bit about where you are now, what you're doing, your training, and your background a little bit.
Certainly. Before I get started on that, I just want to go ahead and thank my co-authors, Ryan Scully and Jason Kappa. They did a fantastic job with the article, and I wanted to make sure they got some credit. My background, I'm originally from North Carolina, went to University of Chapel Hill for undergrad at med school, and then did my residency at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. Had an interest in trauma and did a trauma fellowship, and then subsequently had interest in adult reconstruction, hip and knee arthroplasty, and did a fellowship at Ortho Carolina in Charlotte, and have been in practice now for almost 10 years. Currently, I'm in practice at Washington Orthopedics and Sports Medicine in the Washington, D.C. area.
Awesome. So let's just get right into the article. You know, so for those who are listening, we will always like to point people back to the actual article in the journal. And when you see the title, it's in quotation, outpatient, you know, same calendar, discharge, hip and knee arthroplasty. And so, you know, the first thing we always like to talk about is kind of what drove this article to be written, and you and your co-authors, kind of where the idea for this article came from, if you could give us a little insight into that.
Certainly. Well, you know, this article has been, you know, in the works for a year and a half or so. And thinking back to when we were putting this together, I really was just thinking, you know, it's just time for this article to be written. I have had an interest in outpatient hip and knee replacement really since my joint replacement fellowship, and had some exposure to it there nearly a decade ago. Had incorporated into my practice and had seen the expansion and shift towards outpatient replacement over the last few years, and begun lecturing on it. And the lectures were really well received, and the topic just seemed really timely. And while there was a reasonable amount of literature that it had accumulated there, I didn't feel like there was a great narrative review or a good roadmap on how to do this. And so it just felt like it was time to have this article written, and we were really excited to do it. And we thought it had a lot of educational value and was very, very timely.
Yeah, certainly. And we'll kind of get to it as we go through how much more timely this article has become, certainly this year. But, you know, the biggest thing we want to start with, and this is kind of how you began your paper as well. I mentioned that outpatient was in quotations, and we even discussed a little bit how outpatient seems to have variable meanings depending on the setting. And so you guys started out, I think we're doing a really nice job talking about, when you talk about outpatient arthroplasty, what do you actually mean? And so if you could kind of break down what you guys found when you reviewed the literature, and what is outpatient arthroplasty when we discuss that?
Great question. And it really was really kind of the jumping off point of the article. I remember as I was starting to incorporate outpatient arthroplasty, you know, 8-10 years ago, and starting to review the literature, trying to hone my techniques, figuring out anesthesia techniques and multimodal pain management, and trying to review the literature to figure out how to do this well, the articles were really hard to read, because what I felt was outpatient arthroplasty, and I think generally most people think outpatient means you go somewhere, you have surgery or have a procedure, and you go home the same day. But as I was reading the literature, that wasn't always the case. In fact, there was more literature that patients stayed in the hospital and were called outpatient than there was patients actually leaving same calendar day. And we even chose that very specifically, because there are times that patients were considered same-day discharge when really what they meant was they were under 24 hours of stay, but they stayed technically, you know, overnight and left on a different calendar day. So it made interpreting the literature tough, and we thought it was really important because there probably are big differences in patients or in the experience that patients have and the protocols and techniques between someone that stays in a hospital even for a night or stays overnight in a surgery center compared to someone that you're doing everything to prepare to go home hours after the operation. And so we wanted to be very specific with what we were talking about. And frankly, we felt like that was where this was headed just in orthopedics in general, was trying to get patients home the same calendar day. And we also focused on that in hopes that the future literature that's published on this will be more clear, the definition will be more clear.
And you make an awesome segue, because that's exactly where I was going to pick up was, you know, I think that what you guys do is a really nice job of kind of opening the door to a different direction for the literature, which is specifically, you know, evaluation of how patients do who have surgery and go home the same day. And so maybe even we need to define this as same day arthroplasty, which you do throughout the article, you know, same day discharge. But I think you do a great job defining that. And so, you know, we go from there into what I thought you did a fantastic job of and why I wanted to interview you for this article. And we talked a little bit about beforehand of people listening who are residents and fellows and even attendings out in practice who maybe are doing this but want to do it better or aren't doing it but want to get into doing it. You really lay out a roadmap of how to do this and how to do it well. And obviously, what is arguably the most important part of this whole process is picking who is and who is not a candidate for a same-day arthroplasty procedure. And so if you could just walk us through in your practice and what you found in the literature, what are the pertinent points for preoperative evaluation when you're picking a same-day arthroplasty candidate?
Another good question. And, you know, this is something that has evolved, in my opinion. And we have in the article some data and literature on it. And we talk about the OARA, which is the assessment tool that's been published. And I feel like at this point, that's still more of a research tool and not quite day-to-day friendly when surgeons are trying to counsel patients and select who they think would be a good candidate. But also over the last 5 to 7 years, I've gone from asking myself the question, is this patient a candidate for outpatient surgery, to asking sort of the inverse and saying, why does this patient need to be in the hospital? And that's where this is headed. So, you know, I really think it starts with the surgeon. I mean, we have to take ownership of the whole episode. We have to take ownership of understanding the patient's social situation and really understanding that to offer them the best setting and experience. And really, I need to have a healthy patient. So I ask questions about that. I need to have a patient with good social support. That's really, really important. I mean, it's important for patients that come in the hospital, but it's especially important for patients that are going to go home the same day. And then you have to have a patient who's interested and motivated. We never steer anybody to it. You have to have somebody that really is interested in doing that. And it's important to put in systematic mechanisms to review patients too. You got to review their medical status. And that's part of the whole preoperative evaluation that typically gets done anyway with any arthroplasty, but really is important to have in place when you're offering as a same day discharge.
And that's a really awesome point, I think, that you bring up, which is there's a difference between understanding that, oh, I live at home with my husband, or, oh, I live at home with my husband who has had a stroke and can't walk himself, right?
I actually often ask them, I say, who do you live with? And oftentimes I'll say, I live with my husband or wife. And the follow-up question always is, are they helpful? Usually generates a laugh, but occasionally their spouse or significant other is not helpful. And it's important to understand that.
And I think that's a great pearl, you know, that you mentioned understanding the social situation, but also understanding the motivation of the patient. And you kind of briefly touched on that as well, talking about patients' perceptions of outpatient arthroplasty. And I'm just curious, in your practice, do you find that this is something, are people coming to you asking for this? Has it infiltrated that much of the general population that people are looking for this? Or do you feel like this is still something we're having to talk people into? You briefly touch on it. I'm just curious your experience or what you found in the literature.
Well, yeah, and this is also something I've found that has evolved. This has been such a, you know, rapid is not the right word, but it's been a fairly quick shift over the last decade towards this transition. And so it's a little bit different today than it was before. But, you know, the couple studies that have been published, interestingly, found that patients thought that outpatient replacement was cleaner, meaning they had a less chance for infection, and they felt that they would have a more comfortable experience, which was kind of interesting. But they also had some fears or concerns. They were worried about falling and having pain that was out of control. And they were also, in some cases, worried about imposing on their family or not having support. And so I think it's important to address those concerns and study them and kind of know what patients are, how they're perceiving it, so that we can make sure that their anxiety over pain or social support and deliver that to them is important. But it has evolved. You know, 5 to 8 years ago, patients, when I brought it up, they were, you know, really surprised. It had not really infiltrated the community. And now today, people know people who've done it. And when I mention it to them, I say, you know, I think you're a good candidate for an outpatient procedure. In some cases, they're almost expecting it at this point. And so it's definitely changing. And I think the more ubiquitous this comes, it's going to go back to what I mentioned earlier. Patients are going to ask the opposite question. They're going to say, wait, why do I need to go to the hospital or stay overnight in a hospital? And then you may have to explain to them why you think that's the right thing for them to be in the hospital overnight, or you need the resources of staying in the hospital. But it's just been really fascinating to watch this change.
Exactly. And, you know, like we mentioned at the outset, I think that this is kind of the direction things are heading. You know, it's kind of the same thing as if you brought somebody in and you did a simple arthroscopic meniscectomy on somebody, and then they had to spend the night in the hospital. You know, I mean, people would say, you know, why do I have to spend the night in the hospital? Well, it wasn't that long ago that, you know, people would spend the night in the hospital routinely for procedures like that. And so I think that you're right, that this is the direction that we're heading. And so I briefly want to touch, mostly just referring people back to the article. I think you did a great job talking about pain management as far as a multimodal approach, periarticular injections, neuraxial anesthesia, and regional anesthesia. And we want to refer the readers back to that, as well as management of complications and mobilization of patients. But what I really want to skip to and spend the most time on, Dr. Melvin, which I think is what the listeners are really going to want to know, I have an ambulatory surgery center and I'm in a practice and I do arthroplasty. I feel like I do it well enough and efficiently enough that I could do this. So what is it I need at my surgery center to make this happen? What you mentioned, the infrastructure that you have to recreate from the hospital. So if I want to set up an outpatient joint center at my ambulatory surgery center, what do I need to get done in order to do this well?
Good question. I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all solution, because I've actually practiced in a couple different settings at this point, and there are some differences. But I think it really goes to really owning the entire episode for the surgeon, to really knowing your patients extremely well on the front end and really equipping them for the surgery. And so in our particular setup that we use, we actually found it helpful to send a physical therapist out to the patient's house prior to the operation. And that same physical therapist, for continuity, will see them usually the morning after the operation. But on the preoperative side for them, it, I think, decreases some anxiety that patients have. They get to talk about stairs and walkers and toileting, and really think through it and have somebody educate them on them in person. So there are things like that you got to think through and understand your patient population. You got to have a really strong preoperative team so that you're doing all the risk stratification that you need to do, because you can, you know, schedule a person for an outpatient procedure and then have them, you know, medically evaluated and then decide, hey, you know, based on the recommendation of these experts, we need X, Y, or Z, and this might be better performed at a hospital. So you've got to have that infrastructure in place. And then there's the operative aspect of it, which I think is kind of what you were focusing on with the ASC. And it is a little bit different. Most ASCs are smaller. You know, they don't have the same scale with sterilization of equipment and capacity for storage. And so you've got to think through those things at an ASC. You have to make sure that you have the sterilization capacity to keep up as the volume scales. You got to be able to store the equipment. You've got to be able to manage routine intraoperative complications. You know, you've got to be able to convert from a uni to a total if that's the right thing in that situation. You got to be able to handle a periprosthetic fracture. And you got to think through all these things. So the preoperative planning is even more imperative when you're doing it in a freestanding ASC versus a hospital operating room. But then you got to also think about the postoperative aspect of it as well. And so you've got to anticipate the common complications, things like urinary retention, hypotension, nausea, vomiting. What is your plan to deal with those or prevent them? If a patient needed to be transferred to a hospital, you've got to think about having a transfer agreement or a plan in place to be able to manage that. And then you got to have follow-up with them in that post-operative period. You got to still deliver those patient touches that theoretically they had in the hospital with nurses and rounding and all of that. And so you've got to have that plan in place with return phone calls. All of that, I think, is what is necessary to have a really successful program and have the patients have, you know, not only good outcomes, but I want them to be really satisfied with it. And it seems like from the little bit of literature that's published that patients seem to have a better experience with an outpatient joint replacement. I think it's because of all of that education that we do with the patients and the communication.
First of all, I think that's a fantastic summary. And certainly there's more detail in the paper as far as the complications you talk about being ready for and things you have to address. And I think you do a great job summarizing that into the differences between you're at a hospital and something happens. Well, you have everything you need at a hospital, but that you don't routinely have at a surgery center, and not just intraoperatively, but postoperatively, you know, and things like being able to put in a catheter if someone has urinary retention or things like that that you may not have routinely at a surgery center. But I think the most important point you make is just educating the patients. I think that we have to step back at times and remember that, you know, all of this is new to them, but at least they've talked to people who have had joint replacements and been in the hospital, right? Whereas some of these people, you know, may not even know anyone who has had it and gone home. And so they don't know what to expect and they don't know what's going on. And I think that that term patient touches, you know, when they don't have a nurse there to ask, hey, is this normal? Or, hey, am I doing okay? The phone calls, the closer follow-up, I think are all really important points. The next thing I wanted to address kind of as we wrap things up a little bit is the cost analysis that you talk about at the end. If you could just talk a little bit about what you found as far as how the cost differences are different for the provider as well as the patient.
Sure. There's not a ton of literature out there yet, and I think there will be more on the cost. And most of the studies have focused on the episode cost. So how much essentially does an insurance company pay or get charged, whether they go to a hospital inpatient setting or an outpatient setting? And it's pretty clear from that data that there's a pretty dramatic reduction in cost. And it kind of makes sense. You're just more efficient with your resources, and you know, you don't have to support the entire hospital infrastructure. And some of that actually gets passed on to the patient at this point, you know, with potentially reduced deductibles and copays. I think that in the future, as I predict, there will be more of that passed on to the patient as these protocols become more standard and we can really dig in and look at like itemized billing and understand where the cost savings are coming from. And that's probably more the next step with cost analysis. But then also as we look forward, you know, how this affects surgeons and their practices and facilities like ambulatory surgery centers, also accounting for not only are we good at reducing the cost of the episode and making it very efficient and safe, some of those resources that were provided by the hospital and frankly reimbursed to the hospital are now being borne by the surgeon in the facility. And that's not only a cost in dollars and providing those resources, it's also a cost in time and effort on the surgeon's behalf or their team's behalf in, you know, all these patient touches you still have to deliver, but you're doing it in a different manner. Technology may be able to help with that a little bit. There are patient engagement apps that are out there now that are likely good ways to augment this, but they're not going to completely make up for a phone call or having good education and providing it to the patient. But it's pretty clear that we're going to be able to drive costs down overall, which is ultimately a fantastic thing because, as we all know, we talk about healthcare costs all the time, and hip and knee replacement is one of the largest cost centers for insurance companies, especially Medicare. And so anything we can do to make this more efficient and less expensive while still delivering a very good, safe experience and helping our patients out is going to be fantastic.
Yeah, great point. And I think you say it very nicely in that, you know, I think universally surgeons who can do things, and I love that you said it a couple times, you know, own the entire experience from the minute the patient comes in for that first consult, you know, until that last postoperative visit. If we can own the experience, I think we've shown through every facet of orthopedics and then all fields of medicine, really, that the physicians can do it much more efficiently than the hospitals and the big facilities can, and can ultimately provide a better product and, you know, better satisfaction for the patients. And kind of the last point I wanted to touch on, and we've kind of hinted at it all throughout, is how timely this article is given the recent pandemic and COVID and how that kind of flipped everything on its head as far as people being in the hospital and who can be in the hospital and who wants to be in the hospital, which is no one these days. And I can't help but think that people are going to see this article and that the demand for outpatient anything is so high right now. I'm just curious how your experience providing outpatient arthroplasty has changed with all the COVID regulations that have gone into place and restrictions on who can be in the hospital and kind of how you see this being more of a trend moving forward?
Yeah, I call it the elephant in the room when we're talking with patients these days. You know, we talk about all the usual things, and then at the end, it's like, okay, so what about COVID? What's the situation in the hospital? And yeah, it really added to the timeliness of this article. In fact, you know, this had gone through the editorial process just prior to the pandemic hitting, but it almost felt like we could have added another section in there on it. And since, at least in my area, since we've been back up and doing elective surgery, fortunately, it's been very safe to do it, number one, which I want to emphasize to patients. The protocols and precautions that we've taken have worked. And, you know, thank God there hasn't been any transmission yet, or hopefully never, with the surgery that we're providing patients. But there's been a big increase and really accelerated the shift in patients' interest in outpatient joint replacement. As you mentioned, patients just in general at this stage don't want to come into a hospital for obvious reasons if they can avoid it. Or if they do need to be done at a hospital, then they want the option to recover. And if they're stable and really look good and able to do physical therapy, they can go home the same day from the hospital. And so we've seen a fairly significant uptick in demand and transitioning patients to a, you know, same calendar day discharge. And I think that trend is here to stay, and COVID really accelerated that. And again, touching on what I was mentioning earlier, is that the more patients that do this in the community and have the good experiences that we're seeing, it's really becoming more and more appealing and common. It's similar to the transition that happened, you know, over about a decade ago, when it was less common for patients after joint replacement and in being in the hospital transitioning to a nursing home or a rehab facility. It took a while for the community to kind of grasp that they didn't need to go to a rehab facility for weeks at a time after joint replacement. They can recover actually, you know, more comfortably and actually in some ways better at home. And so this is kind of along those same lines. But yeah, the pandemic has definitely had a huge effect for, I mean, for all aspects of our lives, but especially for outpatient joint replacement.
Absolutely. And I think it's interesting, you know, because you hear the stories about not that long ago, people would have to be admitted to the hospital the night before every surgery. And then, you know, after a hip replacement, people would spend a week in the hospital, and now it's 2 days and 1 day, and now it's the same day. And I think you're right that this will become the new trend and eventually the standard. And I think you do an awesome job laying it out for all of us of what the pertinent points are and how to implement this into our practice. So, Dr. Melvin, it was an absolute pleasure to have you on. We thank you for your time and all the information you provided. And thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks a lot. This was fun.
Absolutely. Well, thank you again for joining us. That's all we have for this month. Again, we want to thank all of our authors who contributed, as always, as well as Dr. Melvin for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this episode as much as we enjoyed making it. Again, we want to thank all the people at the Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons and with the Yellow Journal, and we hope we will see you next month. Everybody take care.